Hello, everybody. Good morning. And this is Bio 241. The date is February 12th, February 1-2, and it's a Thursday. How's that looking? That's looking good as far as the lights are concerned. Yeah, it sure is. All right, so everybody, here's the sign-in sheet. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. Otherwise, you're not here. Just pass it down that way and around and around. Let's look at the schedule first before we continue on with any topics. So if I look at the schedule, do we have a test next time?
No.
No. Ah, okay. Yeah, I'm not sure I have the test ready, so that's good. I have a sigh of relief. So we said today's the 12th, that's a Thursday. We're going to get the second lecture on chapter 6, which is interactions between cells. All right, and then next week we have two lectures as well. Don't forget, Monday is a holiday, but we don't meet on Monday, so you got to come to class twice next week. My Monday, Wednesday classes get gypped out of a lecture on Monday, but you guys don't. You still have all your labs, all your lectures, just as scheduled. And then the Monday after that is your first exam. And you see the chapters, 1, 2, 3, and 6. 1, 2, 3, 6. Okay? And, all right, so this is on the test. This is on the test. So you guys got to listen. Ah, nice, 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 nice. Okay, there was a question. I'm going to get to your question in just a second because I couldn't quite hear. All right, so of course all these chapters are on the test. You have a nice study guide. And so use the study guide to prepare for the lecture test. And you have to talk to your lab instructor for lab quizzes. And don't forget your online quizzes that's tonight. All right, one is due. Hopefully yours is done already. All right, so how do you prepare for the lecture exam? Okay, you guys. Okay, you got to go outside. If you're going to talk, I don't want you to disturb somebody that's listening maybe right next to you, okay? So please pay attention because this is important. Study guide, right? It's got end of chapter questions. It has questions that are within the chapter someplace that you have to know. They might be called check your concept questions. Those you should know before you go on to the next section in that particular chapter. Otherwise, I'm not sure you're spending time well. And what else? Exam figures. There might be something that I have left off the study guide, which is important. And those are the practice quizzes that are in Blackboard that you do before you take the online quiz. So I think they're multiple choice. They might have a difficult set of questions, easy questions. There might be some true-false, and maybe even some fill-in-the-blank type questions. Right. Those fill-in-the-blank are a little tricky because you got to spell things exactly the way whoever wrote the answer key there out. And usually they're pretty good. All right, so please don't forget to look at those online questions. That's good practice. And some of those questions are not very easy. You have to think about them. I know when somebody comes up to me and says, tell me what the answer is for this one, I have to read the question, and I got to think about it. So if I got to read it and think about it, I'm sure you guys do too. So just don't try to memorize those answers. There are a few questions. Remember, I have you look at questions from different editions of the textbook, and every once in a while, there'll be one question, exact same answers, and the answer that's correct is different between the two editions. So you might say, well, gee whiz, how am I going to learn anything from that? Well, I think it's still a very good question. So there is something a little bit wrong with the question to where it makes the answer ambiguous. And sometimes there are actually two correct answers for that same question. So you just have to really analyze the question. One that sticks out in my mind has something to do with lipids, right? Do all lipids have the cyclic structure and are polar or something, all made out of carbon, right? So you should look at that and understand, well, you know, there's phospholipids. What's strange about a phospholipid compared to other lipids? Yeah, it's both polar and nonpolar depending on the end, so you can't strictly classify it as one or the other. Not completely made out of carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen because it's got phosphate. So that question isn't asked really well enough, but if you can understand why the question isn't perfect, that's even a better understanding than if you could answer a really simple question correctly by clicking the right box. Right, so I don't mean to trick you, but I do mean to make you think about those things. Those are really good to think about. And there was a student that sent me another question, and there were actually two answers that were just as good. But there's only one radio button, so you could only pick one, but not two of them. Right? So that helps you get a little confidence, too, in terms of understanding the material. All right, so as far as this exam goes, you need picture ID. You need a basic scientific non-graphing calculator, pencil, eraser 882E or 882ES, but not the 882 LOVAS form. Don't use the LOVAS form, even if there's some around. Yeah. You need a picture ID to identify yourself. Okay. And the reason why is because I have to treat all students exactly the same, otherwise that's prejudicial. And since I teach online classes and students have to come to class once or twice or come to campus once or twice a semester, I want to know who they are because I have no idea who they are. So I require them to show me a picture ID. And so if I require those students to show me a picture ID, then you guys kind of have to go along for the ride too. All right, so that's why. If I required them to wear vinyl gloves during the exam, okay, the online class, what would I have to require you guys to do? Yeah, and it would make no sense. But it's because of the law. It's the rule. Yeah, hi.
Do you have to do like an updated Cypress College or maybe a license?
You need a Cypress College ID for library and all those kinds of services? Oh, you don't have the little sticker on the back? That's okay. I don't check the sticker. Okay. If it's if you don't have that ID, I'll let you take the test, of course. But before I release the grade to you, I'll have to see your ID, picture ID. Okay. Yeah. Question. No. Oh, you're just making a sigh of relief because you have your ID ready to go. Okay. Yeah. Excellent. Excellent. Yeah. Don't surrender that ID to anybody. Okay. Give your driver's license away before your Cypress College ID. Okay. All right, so that's the schedule. We're good with that. Unless there's a question on the schedule. All right, so let's continue on with the lecture. And what can I remember from last time? I kind of like to recapitulate what we did the previous lecture, and I can't exactly remember. Oh, yeah, we were talking about active transport, secondary active transport, passive transport. Okay, I got a couple questions. For passive transport, how does a molecule move in terms of concentration?
High to low.
High to low, right? Same thing for facilitated diffusion, because that's just a special case of diffusion. Now, what about, oh yeah, osmosis is a special case of diffusion, and you should know the three criteria. I don't want to go over that right now, but we went over it pretty well. Make sure you know that, what makes that diffusion process special, if it is osmosis. And then active transport, how do molecules move by active transport? Okay, but I'm thinking just in terms of concentration first. Yeah, low concentration to high, right? And just like if you're going to take your car to the top of a hill, you need energy. When you go from a low position to a high position on a hill, you need energy to do that. Same thing if a molecule is going to move up a concentration gradient. And how many kinds of active transport did we talk about? Yeah, and what were those? Primary and secondary. Yeah, and then I snuck another one in there on you, and that was bulk transport. All right, so I didn't make a really big deal out of that, but bulk transport would be like the third category. But if you're thinking primary and secondary, that's beautiful, that's good, because you should know what the difference is. What's the energy source for primary active transport? ATP, right? So if you're looking at an illustration or reading a word question and ATP is being used up, then you know that is primary active transport, right? And all the nice figures in your book have the ATP with what? It's like gold sunshine around it or something. I'm not sure what it is, but it stands out. So that's primary active transport. What's the energy source for secondary active transport? Cannot be ATP. I almost can hear. Okay, primary active transport kind of sets it up. It is required, but not directly. Primary active transport is indirectly required. But what is the energy source that is most directly required by secondary active transport? It is a gradient, right? It could be an ion gradient. And so that ion will want to move from high concentration to low, and when it does, it gives up energy so other molecules can go the other way in terms of concentration, right? So this is a strange concept, but I want you to see that a gradient in something is an energy source. And whether it's concentration or a gradient of electrical charge, right, then that can be used as an energy source. And how many kinds of electrical charges are you aware of? I heard. Yeah, what are they? Positive and negative. We're ignoring a neutral charge because it doesn't have any charge. Yeah, positive and negative. And what can you tell me about those two charges? Do they attract or repel? They attract, right? So if there's a gradient in electrical charge, those opposite charges do like to attract each other, just like a molecule moving down a concentration gradient. So that is a form of energy. So that takes us to today's lecture, right? And that is membrane potential. And sometimes we can also call that a membrane voltage. It's just a separation of charge. It's a gradient of electrical charge. Some place is going to be positive, another place is going to be less positive, or one place is going to be positive and another is going to be negative in a relative sense, right? So less positive sort of means negative. So it can also be called membrane voltage. This potential is really nice because potential means you have a sense that a potential means that it can promote some other activity in the future, right? So potential means that it can be used as energy. So what the heck is energy? We haven't talked about it, and you can't weigh it, you can't observe it, right? So what the heck is energy? How do you think of energy? Like I can see a cube of sugar on the table, but I can't see like a cube of energy. Okay, potential energy, but you're using the word in the definition that explains it. So that's good, but it's not quite precise enough. And I'm not trying to get to a really precise definition, I just want like an everyday understanding. Energy, the best way to think of energy is it is the ability to do work. Right? Energy is the ability to do work. And so when you have a lot of energy, what can you do? A lot of work or no work? A lot of work. Right, so that's really the best way to think of energy. And when you have a gradient of ions or a gradient of electrical charges, it's what? It's an ability to do work is what it is, because there's energy in that. So maybe you'll have to think of that. That's the simplest way that I can think about energy. Right? It's kind of a hard topic to conceive what it is. Okay. Well, what devices do you own that contain a voltage? Okay, and remember that's a gradient of electrical charge, and it is a source of energy for you, right? So, and somebody said cell phone. Yeah, cell phone. Maybe you have your calculator, has a battery. Anything that has a battery, right, contain a voltage, right? And so a battery usually has two terminals, and if the voltage on those two terminals is the same, exact same voltage on those two terminals, what can you tell me about that battery? Battery is? Yeah, it's dead. That's how we talk about that battery. It's dead, right? And as a matter of fact, if there is ever a cell in your body and there is no voltage across the membrane, that cell is dead also, right? So that's a nice analogy. All right, so how many terminals does the battery have? Two. So we're going to use that concept of a battery to understand a cell. And the cell has basically two terminals. There's one terminal or one area inside the cell, and the other terminal or area is on the other side of the plasma membrane, outside the cell. So this acts like a battery because the extracellular fluid is different from the intracellular fluid. So I want to describe a little bit about how this membrane potential develops, and let's see if I can remember how to do this. I want to do it on the board a little bit. I want to just do a couple of drawings on the board. So I'm going to turn the lights back on, like that, and like that. And you guys really already know all the physical chemistry involved in this. Okay, so what do I want to do? Okay, here we go. Here's a beaker. And then here we have a cell. And I'm going to represent the concentration of a solute molecule just by the number. All right, so the The concentration, let's say, what is this thing right here? That's potassium. All right, and what about inside the cell? It's zero. All right, so what will potassium want to do, if it can? It will want to go from high concentration to low concentration. Right, so potassium is going to enter the cell, and then if we wait over the nice long holiday weekend, what's the concentration of potassium inside the cell? It's going to be the same number right here. Right, we're going to have four of these things. All right. So then, what is this? Does this have an electrical charge on it? This potassium? Yeah, because it's an ion. How many? What kind? Negative. Then it's a monovalent cation. Right, so you're going to have a plus here and a plus here. So what about the voltage across the membrane? We saw that the concentration is going to be the same, but what about the separation of charge? What is the charge going to be like? It's going to be exactly the same. Right? So there's nothing that's going to move this potassium to one side of the membrane or the other. So there are two things that can move this potassium. It's the concentration, but also the electrical charge. Right? These are positive right here. Because if we have something with a negative charge inside the cell, what's going to happen to this potassium, which is positive? It's going to attract it in. So there's two things that will attract potassium to enter the cell. Right? It's the concentration, right? But it's also if the cell has an electrical charge on the inside of it. And if it's the same charge, it will have a tendency to kick potassium out. If it's a negative charge, you can see that it attracts, it's trying to pull more potassium in. And it just so happens, right, we have just tons of proteins in there, and all of these proteins, they're way too big to get across the cell membrane, all of these proteins have a negative charge on them. All right, so these proteins can't get out because they could diffuse out, the high concentration inside the cell, low concentration proteins outside, but they can't get through the membrane, right? That is one characteristic of the rate of diffusion or the rate of osmosis. Whatever is moving has to be permeable through that membrane. In this case, it's absolutely not. All right, so now, what happens to the concentration gradient when we put these proteins that have a negative charge in there? The concentration of potassium won't change in the solution. What about the concentration of potassium inside the cell? Yeah, that negative charge right here is going to even draw some more potassium inside the cell. So eventually, you're going to have more potassium, a higher concentration of potassium inside the cell than outside, at equilibrium, even at rest, right? Because you have to consider the concentration, but also the electrical charge. Sometimes we call that the electrochemical gradient. Okay. Now, not all of this potassium rushes inside the cell, right? Because as soon as the concentration of potassium inside the cell is greater than outside, what does potassium want to do? Yeah, it will want to go from high to low. It will want to leave the cell. And so some potassium will leave the cell, but then again, if it's at equilibrium, some of these negative charges will pull potassium back in. Eventually, it will all even out, and there won't be any net movement of potassium in or out of the cell. But because of these negative charges, you will have a higher concentration of potassium. All right, so there are, for potassium, okay, there are two forces that are working. The chemical concentration. So I want to draw an arrow. So maybe I just want to get rid of these for right now. I want to draw an arrow for concentration. Concentration. Which way in terms of the, and that's just what? Moles per liter, right? That's a concentration. All right. Which way is potassium going to want to go? Just due to the concentration. Yeah, here is high, right? I see six potassiums here, I only see four. So for concentration, that potassium will want to move out. Now what about the electrical gradient? It's negative on the inside, positive on the outside. How would I want to draw that arrow? Which way does that electrical chart? So here I'll say electrical. So we got concentration and electrical forces. Which way is this electrical going to work? What can you tell me about opposite charges? They attract. Positive on the outside, negative on the inside. These potassiums are going to be attracted to the inside of the cell. All right, so let's draw the arrow like that. So we got two arrows. And at equilibrium, when there's no change of potassium, what can you tell me about these two arrows? They have to be equal to each other at equilibrium. One force can't be greater than the other, because if one force was greater of the other, then potassium will want to move in whatever direction it is. At equilibrium, we said there's no motion. So that means that the concentration force is going to be exactly opposite the electrical force, and they will cancel out. Potassium won't move one way or the other, and that's what we call the equilibrium potential. All right. Now, you can't have all these potassiums. You can't have enough potassiums to actually equalize or neutralize all of these negative charges inside the cell. Can't get enough potassium inside the cell, because remember, as soon as you increase the concentration of potassium, then the chemical gradient will start to draw some potassium outside the cell. So you can't completely electrically neutralize the inside of the cell. And where living cells end up is that the inside is a little bit negative, right, and it's positive on the outside, because you can't get enough potassium. Right? As soon as the concentration of potassium increases, then this concentration force is going to draw it out of the cell. Right? So these two things at equilibrium have to be equal to each other. I think that's all I need to draw on the board, at least maybe for right now. So let's take a look at these slides. Let's see if any of these slides correspond to what we were talking about. Oh, here I have a cell. Okay, so far I'm doing good. And here we have some particles, and these are ions, right? I see a 1 plus, it's a monovalent cation. And we're going to say that the membrane is permeable to whatever these things are. Let's just say it's potassium. And let's just think of one ion. And so we see that there are higher concentration of potassium inside the cell. So it's going to want to go from high concentration to low. All right, but because potassium has a positive charge, what's the interaction with these anions? Yeah, it's going to go the opposite direction. So when these two forces right here are equal to each other, the concentration of potassium is not going to change anymore. We call that equilibrium. All right, now, there can't be enough potassium to enter the cell to completely neutralize all the negative charges inside the cell. So the inside of the cell is always going to be a little bit negative compared to the outside, even at equilibrium. And that's where, okay, we come up with the Nernst equation. So we can actually measure that that voltage, right? So here we just have a voltmeter, and here are two leads that we would put on two terminals of a battery. But since a cell is a battery, we can put one lead outside the cell and one inside, and we're going to measure a negative voltage. And a typical voltage across the cell membrane that we're going to use in this class is about minus 90 millivolts. And that's a fairly high voltage, right? Every single cell like that. All right, so at equilibrium, we see that the electrical attraction exactly balances and cancels out the diffusion force. The electrical attraction is inside, diffusion is forcing it outside. These two forces cancel each other, and the concentration of potassium is not going to change, and the voltage is not going to change. But there will always be a voltage, because there can't be enough potassium entering the cell to neutralize every single negative charge on the inside, which means that there's extra leftover negative charges on the inside, and we can see it with this voltmeter right here. So here we have something with two terminals on it, and there's a gradient of electrical charge, right? And that's a cell. So what does every cell in your body act like?
Battery.
A battery, right? Because there's a difference in charge across the membrane, or you could say an electrical potential, electrical difference. Okay. So the concentrations are going to be different. The electrical charge is going to be different across the membrane, because these fixed anions cannot leave the cell. So sometimes we would actually like to measure what that voltage is. And at equilibrium we can, right? If we just leave this cell right here, go to equilibrium, right? The Nernst equation can compute what that voltage is at equilibrium. Gives the membrane voltage needed to counteract the concentration forces acting on the ion, right? Which way is concentration acting?
I don't know.
Okay, high to low. And where's concentration of that potassium high? It was inside the cell because extra potassium was drawn inside the cell because of all the anions trapped inside the cell. Right, so gives the membrane that counteracts the concentration forces. So since you have high concentration of potassium inside, it will want to leave. But since it's a positive charge, it's still attracted back in because of those ions, the negative ions that can't leave. All right, those two forces exactly cancel each other out, and this equation will tell us what voltage, right, develops across the membrane if we let everything go to equilibrium. There will be no net movement of an ion across the cell membrane. So here is the Nernst equation. Right, so this is the potential or the voltage for some ion. We're just going to call it X. And then here is just a proportionality constant that we need to include in our calculations. And Z represents the charge on that ion. We call that the valence. Right? So for sodium, what would we use for Z? What's the valence charge? Plus one. What about potassium? Plus one. What about chlorine? It would be minus one, right? So if we put a one right here, that's real easy. If we put a minus one right here, that's real easy. It's just 61, right? Either positive or negative. If it is for magnesium, has a valence of two plus, then we'd have to put a two here for this Z. All right, so then we multiply that times something that almost looks like the pH equation. It's law times the concentrations, the difference in concentration of that one particular ion on the outside compared to the inside of the cell. All right, so the outside always goes in the numerator and the inside always goes in the denominator. You take the log and it's base 10 times 61 divided by 1 or 2 or minus 1 or whatever it is. All right, and that will then tell you what the voltage is at equilibrium. Okay. All right, so here we see a cell. And this is just the way we're going to typically think of a nice living cell. Where is sodium at a high concentration? If we look at this, we're going to define a cell to be this way. Where is the high concentration of sodium? Yeah, it's 12 millimolar inside, 145 outside. All right, so it's much higher outside. Does that make sense? Is that what you would have guessed? Yeah, absolutely. All right, what about potassium? Where is it higher? Inside the cell? Yeah, 150 inside versus 5 millimolar outside. Does that make sense? Is that sort of what you were expecting? For sure. Okay. So I like these numbers. Chlorine, I don't think any of us would have a sense what chlorine would be because we haven't talked about it yet. But is there a difference in concentration for chlorine across the cell membrane? Is it higher in one spot compared to the other? Yeah, it's higher outside, right? 125 versus 9 millimolar. And what about for calcium? Where is it high? It's relatively high outside the cell. And what is it inside the cell? Really small. You could even think that it's zero, right? But 0.00001. All right, millimolar even. All right, so there should be very little calcium ion running around inside the cell. If there is, that's going to be a very important signal for the cell to do something else. And we're going to look and see what that is in just a little bit. So by knowing at equilibrium what the concentration of these ions are, if we pick just one at a time and plug the concentrations into the Nernst equation, we can calculate what the voltage would be across the membrane at equilibrium. Okay, so that's what we call the Nernst equation will tell us that, and I do want you to be able to calculate that, but that's okay, because you'll have a nice calculator with a log button. So for this equation right here, we can use the Nernst equation for only one ion at a time. We can't combine the effects of all the ions inside our body. It just doesn't work that way. And so this X right here, it could either be potassium or sodium, but it can't be both together. It can only be one, or calcium or chloride. Nernst only calculates one membrane equilibrium potential, but in real life, you know, all of these things contribute to that membrane potential, right? But Nernst isn't sophisticated enough to do that calculation. There are other equations that we won't get into in this class that can do that. All right, so here are some examples, right? What about the equilibrium potential for potassium? How would we work this? We look for the concentration inside and outside, right? So the 5 millimolar goes in the numerator, 150 goes in the denominator, or divide these things, take the log, multiply it by plain old 61, because the valence of potassium is plus 1. And that will tell you in millivolts. So the equilibrium potential in a living cell like this for potassium would be about minus 90. Right? And because the concentration gradient for sodium is the opposite way, it doesn't give you a negative membrane potential. It gives you a positive membrane potential, right? It goes the other way because the concentration gradient goes the other way, right? So 145 outside, 12 inside. Calculate it. That would be the equilibrium potential just due to sodium without anything else. All right, so become familiar with these equations right there. So now let's consider a cell that is at rest. It's not doing anything. That cell is not contracting. It's not sending electrical information anywhere. It's not sending electrical impulses, nerve impulses anywhere. Okay, and so it's at rest, which means the concentration of all these ions is no longer moving. The voltage is stable. It's not changing. So we call that the resting membrane potential, or RMP. And as a matter of fact, I'll probably always refer to it as RMP. RMP is just going to be a constant for a cell when it's not doing anything. Okay, RMP for most cells is negative on the inside, maybe about minus 65 to minus 85 millivolts. I think maybe we're going to use 70 typically in this class. All right, so. And RMP depends on what? The concentration of those ions inside and outside the cell. So the concentration gradient, we could get a handle for that by looking at the Nernst equation and actually calculating what that potential is. Right? But here is something also that's important. Right? It also depends on the permeability of the membrane to each of these ions. And it's most affected by potassium, because potassium at rest has the greatest ability to move through the membrane. Right, so there are little channels that allow potassium to move. Right, we call those leak channels. So potassium is always kind of entering the cell. Even though that sodium-potassium pump is working all the time, still some potassium enters the cell. So from this statement right here, right, we're going to look and see how permeability changes the voltage across the cell membrane. And maybe that's not too difficult to see. So let's go back. Let me go forward. What about forward? Yeah, let's go back. All right, so what did we say? What's the voltage on the inside compared to the outside? It's negative compared to the outside. All right, so what happens to the cell membrane if potassium enters the cell? And it will want to enter the cell because look at that big concentration gradient, right? What happens to the membrane potential as the membrane becomes permeable to it? It's negative inside, sodium is positive. Right, those electrical charges will attract and neutralize each other. So the membrane potential inside the cell will become less negative. Right, so you can see that the permeability also changes the membrane potential. Okay, because these things, when they move, they carry electrical charge with them. Okay, in terms of RMP, some sodium diffuses in. We see over here there's a little bit of sodium that can enter the cell. And so as this positive ion enters the cell, what happens to the voltage inside the cell? It becomes less negative, right? A little bit more positive because sodium is a positive ion. So RMP is less negative than the equilibrium potential that you would calculate for just a potassium ion. That's just one reason why it could be. So we're going to consider a number of effects. Now what about that sodium-potassium ATP pump? Does that produce an electrical gradient across the membrane? And the reason is yes, because right, two potassiums are brought into the cell and three sodiums are kicked out. So what's the effect of that in terms of the charge inside the cell? If two positives leave for every three that, I mean, if three positives leave for every two that enter, that means the inside of the cell becomes a little bit more negative as a result of that. All right, so that's the beauty of this pump right here. All right, but we're going to use this. You should probably just burn this into your memory. This is good. We're going to see how a number of hormones work and why they work a certain way based on this sodium-potassium ATP pump. All right, and so since the ATP pump causes a voltage change across the membrane, we say it is electrogenic. So the sodium-potassium ATP pump has to add to the effects of the change in permeability of the membrane, it has to be added to the effects that we could calculate with the Nernst equation. And so we just said, because of this pump, the inside of the cell becomes a little bit more negative than what you could calculate, and that's what this statement says. It adds about minus 3 millivolts to RMP. It just helps make the inside of the cell more negative compared to the outside. All right, so what are all of these things that help a living cell maintain that gradient of charge across the membrane? Which means what? It's not dead, because it has that electrical difference. Well, first we should think of, well, there's fixed anions that are inside the cell. They can't leave. And these anions inside the cell are going to have a tendency to do what with positive charges on the outside? Yeah, to attract them, right? Okay, and so that's one thing that we got to think of. We also want to consider the permeabilities of the plasma membrane to at least these two ions right here, potassium and sodium, right? So potassium is much more permeable because there are more channels there. You just have to believe me that that is true. I didn't explain why that is, but just assume, okay, that's true, right? And sodium is less permeable, and because the permeabilities are different, that also is going to have an effect on the membrane potential. So permeability affects the membrane potential. These negative charges inside the cell affect that membrane potential. Then what else? Well, we could calculate the equilibrium potential via the Nernst equation. Right, so just the concentration gradients will add or subtract to the membrane potential. And what was the last thing that we talked about? The sodium-potassium ATP pump, because it's not an equal pumping of sodium and potassium. This pump just makes the inside of the cell more negative. So if we add all of these things together, right, we come up with a real-world value of minus 70. Okay, minus 70 millivolts. So we can't just calculate using the Nernst equation what the equilibrium potential is, because for potassium it's minus 90, for sodium it's plus 66, and if you take 90 and add 66 to it, you don't get minus 70, right? You would think, well, maybe you should. But you can't, because it doesn't work that way, because we have to consider all these other things that are happening inside and around the cell, and I don't have a nice mathematical equation for you to do that. Right, but I do for the equilibrium potential. Okay, so let me stop right there for just a second. I think you all know how to use your calculator to do the Nernst equation, but you got some examples you can practice with, right? And that's not bad. But anyway, who's got a question over what we talked about? I think it's important for you to see how that negative charge on the inside of the cell develops, even on a living cell. Okay. The first thing is because those proteins are trapped inside the cell and they have a negative charge. Potassium can help neutralize that charge, but as potassium builds up inside the cell, then it's going to want to diffuse out. Okay, and so there's that equilibrium that is established. But when potassium, as much potassium that enters the cell, there can't be enough to completely neutralize those negative charges that are trapped, so the inside is always going to be a little bit negative. All right, that's the first thing you should think of. And then, of course, I think it's easy to see how the sodium-potassium pump adds some negative charge to the inside of the cell. And this permeability is a mystery to you, but I think you'll get a sense of that as we look at some other details. Yeah, question.
You had a question. Who had a question? No?
No, I'm
okay. Yeah, okay? Okay.
All right, so every cell acts as a battery. And because all of these different effects right here just add together to produce, right, a membrane potential across the membrane so that the inside of the cell is negative right here. Okay. All right, so that's just some basic information we're going to just put away for the moment, and we're going to use that a lot, especially when we get into the nervous system and muscle contraction and many other things. Let's talk about cell signaling. All right, so your body is made up of billions of cells, and these cells are all coordinated with each other. So there are electrical signals that help coordinate your body, but there are also chemical signals that coordinate activity between cells or between different regions in your body. So here is the structural and functional unit of communication between cells, right, and that is the synapse. In anatomy, I think you learned what some of the anatomy of a synapse is, and maybe I'll go over it just a little bit. Okay, but this is how cells communicate with each other. There are two basic kinds of synapses, two different ways that cells can communicate with each other. It can be mostly an electrical phenomena or mostly a chemical phenomena. So there are electrical synapses and chemical synapses. Most of the ways in your body are chemical synapses. Right, so we're going to get electrical out of the way because there aren't many of them, but there are some important tissues that do. All right, so on this slide, what do we see? Cell membrane. You all see the cell membrane right here? That's making a cell on top, and then there's another cell down here on the bottom. Here's another cell membrane. Here's the intercellular space. These cells are kind of glued together because there are tight junctions and desmosomes, and here is one called a gap junction. So these are proteins in the cell membrane that come together that line up these two cells right next to each other, and this gap junction is special because there's a big hole through this particular protein. There's a big channel. You could consider this a channel. And this channel, as far as I know, never closes. It's open all the time. All right. So let's look at this top cell. Where is sodium at a high concentration? Outside or inside this cell on the top? Sodium? Yeah, sodium is high outside the cell. So here you have a lot of sodium outside the cell. And yeah, sodium, when it's outside the cell, if we stimulate this cell, one way that we stimulate a cell is that we open a channel for sodium, right? And sodium is going to move down its concentration gradient from high outside to low inside the cell, so there's going to be a big rush of sodium inside the cell. The cell has changed the permeability to sodium. So what happens to the membrane potential as sodium enters the cell? Does it become more negative or less negative? Less negative. When it becomes less negative, it means it's going closer to zero. We call that depolarization. Depolarization, you're going to see, is an excitatory event. It's a stimulation. It's not inhibition, right? It's excitation. So this top cell has been excited because sodium has entered. The membrane potential changes. Now we have a higher concentration of sodium inside the top cell, but what about this bottom one? It is still at, is that high concentration or low? It's low. Okay, but now we have high above it, low down over here. Here's a way for sodium to diffuse, and what's going to happen to sodium? It's going to flow into the cell on the bottom. All right, and as sodium flows into the cell on the bottom, what happens to the membrane potential of the cell on the bottom? It becomes less negative. We define that to be depolarization. That is another excitatory event. So this top cell has excited the bottom cell via that electrical current or that flowing of sodium through, what did we call this thing right here? That's a gap junction, right? And even though sodium is a chemical, I understand, but what I want you to think about is that flow of positive charge. So this is what we consider an electrical synapse because those positive charges can flow from one cell to the next, right? And it is excitatory. If this is a muscle cell, that influx of sodium is going to cause the muscle to contract. Right. So if all the muscle cells in your body had gap junctions, what would happen to your body if you told one muscle to contract? If sodium went into one muscle because you told it to contract, that muscle would contract, but what else? Everything else in your body would contract. Right. That, so you can imagine that skeletal muscle does not have gap junctions, right? Because I could never reach out and grab that Coke bottle right there. Right. As soon as I would try, I would just go into spasm. That doesn't happen, right? So that neuromuscular junction doesn't have gap junctions, but there is a muscle that does. There is an organ in your body that should contract as a unit no matter what, right? And it's not skeletal muscle, it is cardiac muscle, right? Your heart has to beat as a unit, so heart is a really good example of where we find these electrical synapses allowed by these gap junctions. So we just have to excite one cell, the whole heart is excited as a result. All right, so which type of synapse is produced by a gap junction? Electrical, because I want you to think of that positive charge on a sodium moving from high concentration to low. That changes, right, the voltage across the cell. Okay, here is another kind of synapse. All right, some chemicals or some cells respond to a chemical signal. Right, and if a cell responds to a chemical signal, we call that a target cell. In order for a cell to be a target cell, it has to have a receptor for that chemical agent that is trying to send it a signal. Right, so you could think of this in terms of a response loop. In order for these cells over here to respond, they have to be able to recognize the stimulus. The stimulus is an increased concentration of some signaling molecule. Right, so if you want to be able to see, right, you need photoreceptors. Right, if you want to taste a sugar molecule, you need to have sweet receptors on your tongue. And so there are all different kinds of receptors. So here is one tissue, and it might want to signal some activity in another tissue nearby. It will synthesize that chemical signal, release it by secretion to the outside, to this interstitial space. This molecule will move by diffusion from high concentration to low, and it will bump into all of these cells over here. But before these cells can respond, what do they have to have? They got to have a receptor to that compound. If they don't have a receptor, they're going to be completely like blind to it. They won't notice that it is there. It has to have a receptor. Okay. And so we call this paracrine signaling. Cells secrete regulatory molecules that just diffuse to nearby cells. Diffusion works only under very small distances. Can't work for very long distances, like from your brain to your big toe. This won't ever happen. Won't even happen from your wrist to your thumb. That's still way too large a distance. All right, so just a microscopic distance. Well, let's see, I have put a couple of questions down here. Let's see if these questions still make sense to me. What must the target cell contain in order to respond to a signal molecule? Receptor. Yeah, okay, that still makes sense to me. Okay, what must be the shape of the binding site to the paracrine receptor? Of the paracrine receptor. What is the shape of the binding site of the paracrine receptor? It's got to be a matching shape. Exactly right. All right. So this signaling compound, if it is a sphere, then the receptor has to be? Yeah, spherical or circular in some place, right? So it just matches up. So it's the shape, it's the anatomy of these molecules that make the system work. And if you change the shape of these molecules, what happens to the function of the system? It changes as well, right? So even molecular shape is very important. So this right here is not an example of an electrical synapse. This is an example of a chemical synapse, because what's being moved across from one cell to another is this chemical compound. Okay, so here is a pretty good example of a chemical synapse. Here we have a neuron, and you guys should know what kind of neuron this is, maybe some of the function of it. Who knows what kind of neuron is this? It's a nice multipolar neuron. What's multipolar used for? Yeah, for motor, right? It's not sensory neuron, it's a motor neuron. So these cell bodies will be maybe in the spinal cord, and then this axon is going to move out of the spinal cord to a skeletal muscle here. All right, so here is what? An efferent pathway or motor pathway to this skeletal muscle. When this neuron becomes excited, right, it's going to cause the release of this signaling compound from this terminus of the neuron. Sometimes we call that a little Bouton terminale or neuron terminal or something like that, because it's filled with vesicles, filled with neurotransmitters. That causes the release of neurotransmitter, and it's going to diffuse across the synaptic cleft, and it will bind to this muscle right here if the muscle has a receptor for it. And when it binds to the receptor, then this muscle is going to change its physiology by contracting. Okay? So here's a really good example of what kind of synapse, electrical or chemical? Chemical. What is the signaling compound? What is the chemical that's being used as a signaling compound? Okay. Let's just say general first. What is a general, okay, the general name for a compound that's used as a signaling molecule by a neuron? Yeah, I just wanted to go all the way back to like the beginning. So it's a neurotransmitter, right? Because it's being released by a neuron. And as a matter of fact, there are numerous kinds of neurotransmitters, and that's what you guys were just telling me. So go ahead, give me some specific examples of a neurotransmitter. Acetylcholine, right. And as a matter of fact, that would be exactly working right here if this is a skeletal muscle. That's the only neurotransmitter that skeletal muscle responds to, because that's the only receptor that it has. Okay, what's another kind of neurotransmitter maybe you've heard of? Dopamine, yeah, serotonin, epinephrine, norepinephrine, right? So there's a whole bunch of different kinds of neurotransmitters. We'll talk about some of these in the class. Right, so when we talk about those neurotransmitters, it's what? It's a chemical synapse of some kind. And so this effector organ right here has to have a receptor. All right, so the signal within this neuron is an electrical signal. The membrane potential changes. It's an electrical signal, right? But that electrical signal can't hop across the synaptic cleft because then it would be like a lightning bolt. We don't have lightning bolts in our body, right? There's enough insulation. So how does that signal move across the synapse? As a chemical, as a neurotransmitter, as a chemical signal. And then when that chemical signal binds to receptor, then that starts another electrical signal on the surface of the membrane of this muscle cell. So when we think about communication between a neuron and a muscle cell, it is electrical, chemical, electrical. So now you begin to see that a muscle cell has some similarities to this neuron. It's going to have similar kinds of proteins in the membrane because it does rely on membrane potential or changes in electricity across the cell membrane to change its physiology. We're going to see the same kinds of proteins in the membrane that do that. What must be the shape of the binding site of the neurotransmitter receptor? Yeah, it's got to match up with the the neurotransmitter. Changes shape, then that receptor won't work. So as a matter of fact, that receptor right here, you could use all of those characteristics that we use for transporter molecules, right? There's competition, there's saturation, and there is specificity. It means the shape has to be complementary. All right, so we're going to use those same concepts. In endocrine signaling, right, here we have some cells that are producing a signaling compound. It secretes it to the outside of the cell. These cells in this local neighborhood do not have a receptor for it, so none of the cells in this local neighborhood will respond to this signaling compound. But because it's low concentration in the blood, that signaling compound will diffuse from around these cells into the blood. And then where does it go once it's in the blood? Everywhere that blood goes, which is, you know, basically everywhere in your body. So that signaling compound travels everywhere in your body, and then it can diffuse out and everywhere in your body. And when it bumps into a cell that has a receptor, then it can change the physiology of these cells at some distant location from the cells that secreted that compound. All right, and since it has a receptor to that signaling compound, we call that a target organ, target tissue. This is an example of an endocrine system. All right, and this particle that gets into the blood is what we call a hormone. Right, so a hormone is a compound secreted by an endocrine gland that enters the circulatory system, travels to a distant location, and it changes the physiology of that target tissue because it has a receptor. So that's how we want to think about a hormone. And so these are endocrine glands. Now, why is it? What kind of blood vessel is this? It's special. Okay. What kind of blood vessel allows for exchange? Yeah, and only a capillary, right? Capillary and only a capillary. So things can diffuse in and out of your circulatory system only at capillaries. So what kind of blood vessel is over here? Another capillary, right? Because things are diffusing out. Right. In this area, blood is just being transported. So I see it kind of looks the same, but it should really be like a vein or an artery or something like that. Veins and arteries are way too thick to allow for diffusion. So something that's in an artery or vein can't leave. If there's something outside an artery or a vein, cannot enter, right? And maybe we can talk about this. That's why CPR regulations got revised a couple of years ago, right? Because when you have oxygen in your arteries, it can't leave, right? And so that's why we do more chest compressions than we do breaths, because we need to get that blood going, right? All that blood in all those arteries is great blood. It's loaded with oxygen. Can't get out until it gets to the brain. Okay. All right, so how do these regulatory molecules influence target cells? We said target cell has to have a receptor. We got different kinds of signaling compounds. We can have hydrophobic or hydrophilic signaling compounds. This is why we spend a lot of time understanding some of that physical chemistry. So what kind of molecule can move across the cell membrane, hydrophilic or hydrophobic? Hydrophobic, which means it is nonpolar. I know you got to do some gymnastics there to kind of remember all this stuff, but you know, I think it really makes nice sense. All right, so if we have a nonpolar regulatory molecule, can it get through the membrane? Yes, it can travel right through the plasma membrane. So where are the receptors for that lipid-soluble hormone? It is inside the cell. That hormone easily gets inside the cell, binds to a receptor. That receptor then, when it binds, we call this little thing, this little hormone, a ligand generally, that's a ligand that binds to this bigger molecule. That's going to change the physiology of this particular cell. And we're going to look at a bunch of different mechanisms. Most of the time, it's going to change protein synthesis inside the cell. We haven't talked about protein synthesis yet. But what's important, hydrophobic molecules have cytoplasmic receptors. Cytoplasmic receptors. Here are some examples. Steroids, yeah, you know those to be lipids. Thyroid hormones, nitric oxide, we haven't really talked about these yet, but they can diffuse through the cell membrane. But we did talk about steroids. All right, so most steroids can affect the cell through protein synthesis. They regulate protein synthesis inside the cell that's at a distant location compared to the endocrine gland. All right, so that's hydrophobic regulatory molecules. What's the other kind? Hydrophilic. What about a hydrophilic molecule? Can it get inside the cell? Absolutely no way, right? Because the membrane, the inner part of the membrane is the lipid part, and only lipids can get through that barrier. So any kind of hydrophilic, any kind of regulatory molecule that readily dissolves in water cannot get inside the cell. So how's it going to change the physiology inside the cell if it can't even get in there? Okay, a lot of people won some Nobel Prizes but figured this out. Okay, and that's because there's a receptor that's on the cell membrane that's pointing to the outside. So this regulatory molecule doesn't have to get inside the cell because the receptor is extracellular. It's on the cell membrane. So that hydrophilic regulatory molecule binds to this receptor, and that receptor, you can see, goes across the membrane. Part of it is inside, part of it is outside. And the part that's inside then will change the physiology, will actually produce another signaling compound inside the cell. And as that other compound builds up inside the cell, it's going to change the physiology. All right, so that's just a very general description. We're going to have to learn some particulars in this class about that, but this is a really nice theme. Okay, so we got a couple signaling molecules. We got one that's outside, one that's inside. The one that's outside, we're going to call that the first messenger. The one that builds up as a result of binding the first messenger to receptor is called the second messenger. And where do you always find second messengers? Inside the cell. Where do you always find first messengers? Outside the cell. Right? And second messengers only build up inside the cell if the first messenger binds to the receptor on the outside of the cell. That might seem a little mysterious because it's just so simple, but I think this is a good place to start. Okay? So you got two different kinds of receptors depending on the physical properties of that signaling compound. If it's a lipid, they are cytoplasmic receptors. If they're water soluble, they are what, extracellular or on the cell membrane. First messengers are always outside the cell. What can you tell me about the physical properties of this first messenger? Is it hydrophilic or hydrophobic? Hydrophilic, that's right. Hydrophilic, can't get through the cell membrane. Okay, here are some second messengers that we're going to be familiar with. There are ions. A really important second messenger is calcium. Now, where is calcium normally at a high concentration? Outside the cell. And what was it inside? Almost zero, right? It was 0.0000, right? So without any kind of stimulation or excitation, the cell won't be driven by any kind of calcium signal. But when something changes the permeability of calcium so it can enter the cell, then it can be a nice signaling compound, right? So it can go from very low concentration to high concentration. Cyclic AMP, it can be considered another second messenger. Cyclic AMP comes from an ATP molecule, right? And if we take two phosphates off of an ATP, we end up with an adenosine monophosphate, just one phosphate, and this is a special form of that adenosine monophosphate. And the C right here stands for cyclic. It makes a ring structure. So it's not any old kind of AMP. It has to have the ring structure. What happens to AMP if it goes from a ring structure to just a nice linear form, if that ring is broken? Will it have the same effect inside the cell? No, because the shape has changed, right? Change of shape, completely change the function. Some others, G proteins. And here are a couple others that we're going to talk about. We're just going to call that DAG and IPI3 when we get to it. All right, so there is a really nice list. Here is a Signal transduction scheme. Signal transduction just means how can a signal go across the membrane from outside to inside? That's signal, okay, transduction. All right, here is one really good way. It's by using G proteins. G proteins is a highly conserved kind of mechanism, right? It's very ancient in terms of evolution. Almost every kind of living organism can rely on these kinds of second messenger pathways. Right, so G protein is part of a second messenger pathway. Where are we going to find these G proteins if it's a second messenger? Yeah, inside the cell. Okay, a G protein contains three subunits, and when a signaling compound binds to a receptor, these three subunits can break apart. We call that dissociation. Just like when you put sodium chloride crystal into water, it dissociates into sodium and chlorine ions. Okay, and then these subunits can wander around inside the cell or on the inside of the plasma membrane, and they can bind to receptors, right? These activated G proteins can bind to receptors, and then will change whatever is connected to that receptor. It might be an ion channel that goes from a closed to an open configuration. It can be an enzyme that is inactive, right, and it can be converted into an active form, or the reverse way. All right, so we're going to learn some specific examples. Here is a nice general scheme for a G protein. What do we got here? Nice cell membrane. Okay, here's extracellular. Here's intracellular. We said a G protein is a second messenger. Does this diagram show you that this G protein, I see the three subunits right here, does that look like it could be a second messenger? Yeah, because it's inside the cell. All right, here is that regulatory molecule. That is, what messenger is this one right here? That's the first messenger. So this complex is what we call a G protein coupled receptor. G protein coupled receptor. The receptor and the G protein are all connected together, but the G protein is inside the cell. When the receptor binds to it, what did we say? These subunits can dissociate. All right, so this beta and gamma subunit dissociates from the alpha subunit, and these subunits can kind of wander around right on the inner surface of the cell membrane. Okay, they don't really float around inside the cell very much, and they can bump into other proteins in the cell membrane, right? And the alpha subunit can also bind to other proteins. Could be an enzyme, could be a channel, right? And so an enzyme is going to produce an effect inside the cell, or I'm sorry, that protein is going to cause a response inside the cell. This protein will cause a response inside the cell. What do we call something that produces a response in terms of your response loop? Yeah, stimulus always produces a response. Stimulus always precedes the response, but produces a response. You got to draw that little square in. It is an effector. Yeah, effector produces a response. So when these things bind to these receptors, just generally speaking, it produces a response. Right? That's all you have to know. You don't have to know what the response is. Okay. Then these things will dissociate from these effectors, right? And that's going to terminate the production of that response. They're going to join together back at the receptor. And now we have, right, a G protein coupled receptor once again. Okay, but as these G proteins come back together, you see this little GTP, guanosine triphosphate, that's a high energy compound just like ATP. You should think of it as ATP. It just has a little bit different base, right? So you think of it, and that's why we call it a G protein. When all of these subunits come back together, that G protein is hydrolyzed. And you know what hydrolysis is, right? So water is added, this phosphate group comes off, right? And now they can form this structure once again, but this is an inactivated G protein. To be activated once again, this GTP has to exchange itself with a GTP molecule. Right? So the GTP will replace the GDP, and now you have an activated G protein coupled to this receptor, and the cycle can start over and over again. All right, so this requires energy, this production of the second messenger, regulation of the second messenger. Where does that energy come from? ATP, but it's in the form of GTP. Okay, so that hydrolysis of GTP before these subunits can come back together is the energy that drives the association of these proteins back together again. And then it's ready to bind another signaling compound. Okay, so this is our last slide. This is an exempt figure. So what kind of nucleotide is required for a G protein to work? What kind of guanine triphosphate, not ATP, right? GTP. And that's where this G protein came from. All right, and the G protein, is that a first messenger or a second messenger?
Second
messenger, right? So those are really some of the prime concepts that I want you to see on this diagram. And you might be feeling a little uncomfortable because you can't relate this very general scheme to specific things that are happening inside your body, but we're going to use that. We're going to use this scheme right here to describe some very specific things, right? How specific functions are controlled inside cells by this particular kind of receptor. All different kinds of things. Ion channels, enzymatic reactions can be controlled by these G proteins right here. Okay, so that's it. Now, who's got a question? Who's got a question? Anybody have a question?
Well, we still have 20 minutes left, huh, in class? Something like that, I think. When do we go to? 45, 12:45? Okay, not quite 20 minutes, almost 20 minutes. Okay. Okay.
No questions on this? How are you guys doing in lab?
Okay. I know I helped some students with some questions. I'm not sure I could remember the question and how I answered it, but I maybe would want to go over how I kind of figured out how I answered it. Maybe I should draw some stuff on the board. Huh? Indirectly. Indirectly. But I won't ask you like to convert concentrations to percent. Stoichiometry? No. So you do a lot of diffusion, you do some chemistry experiments, those things directly relate to lecture. I tell you what. Okay.
Yeah. It's good background information. For the lecture exam, yeah, definitely. Okay. Okay, questions at the end of this chapter?
At the end of this chapter that dealt with osmolality and molality.
Oh, yeah, those are excellent. Okay. I like those.
So those.
Okay, the reason why I know, because if you look in the study guide, guess what? Those numbers of those questions are there.
Right.
So if you're really going to prepare yourself for the lecture exam, use the study guide.
Okay, so
but unfortunately, I have a really gross omission in the study guide. I mentioned that at the beginning of class. Where else do I get questions from? Yeah, the practice quizzes that are online from the textbook. They're basically from your textbook. Okay, they're not in your textbook, but they're made by the same publishing company. Okay, so be sure you go over those. I just realized that this semester. Maybe that's why everybody flunked the first exam, usually. I don't know.
Don't say that.
Yeah. About what? Okay, here's a good question. It might help you on the test. Okay, rephrase the question so I see. Maybe I'll go back to two screens, like that. Okay, can you formulate a good question? I know.
Okay, you know the practice quizzes that we're supposed to be studying as well?
Online.
Yes.
Yeah.
Not all of those
questions, right? Just the ones that I have in Blackboard.
Yeah. And how the other book is before those, we're supposed to like go and look on the practice?
Both of them.
For some reason that link won't work for me.
Oh, you got a problem with the link.
Yeah,
you gotta let me know.
Not the quizzes, just for to go look at the different panels.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Okay, here's something funny about those websites. If you use a link to get into an edition of the textbook, let's say edition 13, the program knows that you're looking at edition 13, so that if you hit the link in my Blackboard course for edition 11, it's going to come back and say, hey, you're in edition 13, why are you asking me for 11? And it will kick you out.
So
what you can do is tell Blackboard that you want to go to, from 13 to 11, click on that link one time, you'll get the error message or nothing will happen. You click on it a second time, and then it will say, oh, you really wanted to do that. Okay? And I think that's maybe what you're talking about. You might have to just have no idea why two independent clicks on that link have to be used. Right? I think sometimes I have the URL in that page, so if you copy that URL and paste it into a browser, that will take you there too. And all you need to do is break into one chapter in each of those editions, and then you have a pull-down menu, and you can select what chapter you want to go to. You just got to figure out a way to get in there. Try linking one time, and then try to link up again. Yeah.
Okay, let's say, for instance, the
prostate. Okay, you better speak up really high.
Oh, you know the prostaglandins? You know how, like...
Prostaglandins!
You know how they kind of look the same in a little handout for chapter 2?
Yeah.
Yeah, are you going to ask us, name this one, or you just want
to... No, you don't have to be able to... So... As far as sugars go, you don't have to be able to recognize the difference between glucose and galactose, right? And the same thing for prostaglandins.
Okay.
You should just be able to tell me that the general structure of a prostaglandin is a folded over fatty acid.
Okay,
and you don't have to tell me which kind of prostaglandin it is. Same thing for steroids. You don't have to tell me if it's estradiol or testosterone or cholesterol. Just a general shape, yeah. Now, some other molecules, you do have to know some more specific structures, like a phospholipid. What does it have?
Phosphate.
Yeah, it's got that phosphate that makes it polar. Yeah, and the fatty acids that make it hydrophobic.
I prefer the term lipid or fatty acid. It doesn't matter.
Lipid includes a whole lot more different kinds of compounds than fatty acids. So fatty acid is a lipid, but not all lipids are fatty acids, because some lipids are steroids, which have nothing to do with fatty acids. Yeah. Okay. We could go over the chemistry flash quiz.
Yeah,
I think maybe that would be a really good thing to do. Yeah, what's your question? Isotonic glucose solution. In terms of a percent, you mean? Yeah, I don't have it memorized. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe you could see me. Oh, yeah, it's in your lab book? Okay, I'll look into that. Yeah. All right, let's pull up that. Okay. Another good question. Okay, speak up really loud because it's getting a little noisy in here. I know, your voice might crack or something.
Really well for each chapter for the exam, we should look at the study guide,
do
those questions, do the end of the chapter questions.
Those are in the study guide.
Yes, look at all the figures you have.
Those are in the study guide.
check
your concepts, probably.
And then all the quizzes before the practice ones and...
No, just the practice ones that I have online.
That's what I meant.
I have a bunch of other pages in there that might have a video with some questions after that. Yeah, pretty much. But if you're going to really focus on one thing, anything in the study guide plus those review questions from the different editions of the textbook. But just the ones that I have on the website.
So what I asked you about, those ones you were talking about?
Yeah. Maybe I should, if I have time, let's log in. Let's go through the flash quiz first. Okay, well, we've been working really hard today. So here is a rest station. Right, we don't have to identify anything. All right, but we want to know what kind of structure this is. What do we got right here? Oh, I see a phosphate, I see the sugar molecule, and I see a base. Base, sugar molecule, phosphate, that is a nucleotide. It's a building block of a nucleic acid. But remember, there are two general kinds of nucleotides. Which one is this? I see an oxygen. Could this be the deoxy form? Or just the right? It can't be deoxy because I see an oxygen right there. So this is what we call a ribonucleotide. Right? And ribonucleotides make up what kind of nucleic acid?
RNA,
not DNA. Yeah. Okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So it sort of makes sense. The other thing for the test, don't forget periodic table. You have to know how to use that periodic table. Atomic mass, chemical symbols, that's basically it. Right. Or how to calculate molecular weight. You need a periodic table. All right, what's that? That was a sulfhydryl group. And here is an amino group. I gave you a hint on that one. What about this? Carboxyl group. Is that an acidic or basic kind of function? Okay. All right, it is acid. It does have this OH right here, but the whole OH doesn't jump off. It's only the hydrogen. The oxygen is left, and then it has a little minus sign. So a carboxyl group will donate this proton to a solution. Anything that donates a proton to a solution is an acid. Yeah, is an acid. Okay, carboxyl group. Here is phosphate group. This is also an acid because this proton can be donated. Both of these can. Okay. Inorganic phosphate would be just this part of it right here.
Okay.
Okay. And it would probably also have a hydrogen attached to it, depending on what the pH was.
Okay.
Okay. So this would be an organic phosphate. What do we got here? I see a nice monosaccharide. How many carbons? I think that's good if you know how many carbons you see right there. How many carbons do you see over here? Six is going to be the same, right? Six. If we chop it in half, how many carbons are we going to have?
Three.
Three, right? Three and three. All right. What is this here? It's a fatty acid. Right, here's the acid group, and it's saturated at every carbon. There are two hydrogens. That's how they came up with the term saturated. All right, and ooh. Yeah, what's the chemical process in this direction? Yeah, because here's water coming out. That's dehydration synthesis. Right, and so this is a triglyceride synthesis because you need a glycerol and three fatty acids. You know, make sure you can recognize this glycerol right here. How many carbons does it have?
Three.
Would you be able to calculate the molecular weight of this thing?
Yeah.
Right? So whatever the atomic mass of carbon multiplied by three, right? So oxygen by three, add them together, plus how many hydrogens are there, right? And then you would have the molecular weight. Okay. What's the reverse reaction called?
Hydrolysis.
And these are reactions that happen over and over and over again, and I use those terms throughout the lecture, hydrolysis. Like when you break ATP down, that's a hydrolysis reaction. Okay? Okay. Next kind of slide. It's another monosaccharide, but a little bit different kind. Okay? Because this functional group is in a little bit different location on the sugar molecule. Here we got a micelle. Make sure you can tell that these are water molecules. And what kind of molecule is this thing right here? Not phospholipid, and you should know about what's happening on either end of this phospholipid. What molecules are there that give it that physical property? Yeah, and then get a sense for why it forms that structure. Okay, what do we got here? Steroids. Unsaturated fatty acid. The carboxyl group is on the end. Here is something that's really easy. An amino group and an acid group. So here's an amino acid. There's no such chemicals with a symbol R, it just means what? It could be any number of different things, right? That's a functional group. It could be something simple like a hydrogen or something much more complex than that. So this is amino. What is this a building block for?
Protein.
All right. Yeah, this is that strange one. No matter what kind of company it's in, it's happy, right? Because here is the hydrophobic end. Here's the hydrophilic end. Make sure you can identify this on the test. If I turn it upside down, backwards, inside out, or whatever, okay, how are you going to identify a phospholipid? What are the building blocks of a phospholipid? Building blocks are two fatty acids, right? And then this one phosphate group. That's all I want you to know.
What's the other part?
It's a phosphatidyl group in general, okay? Okay. But we don't need to get into that much biochemistry. Okay, here we have prostaglandins. Here we have secondary structure. What is this the building block of? What is this the building block of?
Tertiary
structure. Yeah, thank you. And if you change this structure, what happens to tertiary structure? Yeah, it changes. What do we got here? Yeah, this is a deoxyribonucleotide because this is a ribose sugar. All right. And there's no oxygen right here, so this is a building block for DNA. Yeah. which is a nucleic acid. So a nucleotide is a building block of a nucleic acid. Here we have
hydroxyl group.
Here we have glycerol. Maybe you should draw this out 10 times. Okay? Yeah, well, how many every time? Just from memory. And you can stop after you do it perfectly. Okay? You don't have to do it 10. Maybe you could do it twice or three times. Ah, what did Bruce, anybody know Bruce Lee? Bruce Lee, best martial artist in the whole world ever. And if he ever wanted to know how to punch or kick or do a certain kind of block, how many times would he have to practice that block? Okay. I said 10 times for drawing that molecule. Bruce Lee would tell you 1,000 times. And then his body knew what it was doing. Okay? Okay. So, I don't know if you have to draw that glycerol out 1,000 times, but maybe some fraction of that. What is this right here? A carbonyl group. Carbonyl group. Here is... Oh, this. That's all I have. Right? Here is the ribonucleic acid. All right, so that's pretty good as far as the chemistry goes. All right, so don't forget, when you make a protein, it is a dehydration synthesis. When you make a complex sugar, a polysaccharide, it's a dehydration synthesis. Go the other way, it's always going to be hydrolysis reaction. Okay, I see one more really good question, yes. But you're going to have to really speak up. Okay, yeah, kind of. Maybe, I don't know what to tell you. So you right-click, download it to your computer, store it on your hard drive, and then double-click. And this is just, these are just pictures. These are just JPEGs. So any kind of picture viewer, it should work just fine. Okay. I don't know what kind of picture viewer you have. All right, you want to see exactly where those questions are that could be on the exam. Okay, so these are just JPEGs. So if you can open up a JPEG anywhere on your computer, you should be able to open these up. Okay, so where do you find those questions? Got to go online. We said it's in Blackboard. So you got to get into Blackboard. Yeah. 1, 2, 3. Ah. I hope that. Oh, it won't work. I know why. Never mind. Oh, I changed it. It's always so difficult to remember your passwords. You think I should type it in? But you know, I also did change the password. There. It's not getting this key. I don't know how many letters it is. Okay, sign-in sheet. Please sign the sign-in sheet.